Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And this, as of this recording, is going to be the last episode of 2017 pre-holiday, and then I'm taking a much-needed break, so I'm very happy about that. And I'm also happy because we were talking about you being on since last year. We're going to have Nidhi Chinnani, who is the author, illustrator, or should I just call you cartoonist?
Yeah, that works too.
Cartoonist of Pashmina, which came out this fall. I bought a copy the day it came out, and it's gorgeous and beautiful. And I've been a fan of Nidhi's work since I was introduced to your stuff last year. And you've had a lot of your cartoons come up online. You have your wonderful, wonderful website where you do all your illustrations and your Instagram presence. So I'm just really happy to end this year with you as a guest.
Yeah, I'm super happy to be your last guest and to be in this place in the year. And actually, rescheduling this worked out because now I feel like I have a lot more perspective on things and probably have hopefully more interesting things to say.
Oh, you'd be interesting. I wish you hadn't gotten sick because that sucked.
Yes, it did. It sucked to get sick mid-tour for sure.
So you are the capper for my last 4 or 5 months of women of color guests. Congrats. And then we will have more next year. We're going to have some dudes too. It's going to be fine. But I've just noticed, I said, I've had only women of color since, I think, August. That's amazing.
It is amazing.
Yes.
But it's kind of feeling, like you said, you know, the end of the year, I have a lot of things going on, but I also feel a little more relaxed, partly because I'm having a couple days off. So I feel definitely in a different place now than I was like last week. Good. So
yeah, and we're recording this 2 days before Thanksgiving. So theoretically, we are going to have a break. Probably
yes.
Not really, but theoretically, that's kind of what we want to do.
Well, I was basically promoting for about a month and change. And then I told myself I was going to take all of Thanksgiving week off. And literally, the Friday, my last day off, and then Saturday and Sunday, I'm doing a craft show in San Francisco. So I don't even get the weekend off, but I get the whole week off. So, It's all good.
All right. So we're going to enter into the first question about you being an artist and the pursuit of that. Because I watched, and I'll link to it as well. Nidhi was part of the Champions of Change, AAPI, Asian Americans Pacific Islanders panel from a few years ago. And that was at the White House. I mean, you've been to the White House. That was at the White House, no? Or what am I?
The Obama White House, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Good times. Good times.
Yeah.
I'm amazed. I'm in awe. That was a really good panel. It was really fun to watch. And it's on YouTube. Again, I'll link to it. And you mentioned you went to art school, but not graduate school. And I was interested because I really like talking to illustrators. I just spoke to Vashti Harrison last week. And I wanted to know about what sparked being a student of literature, but also what you learned from art school that caters to your craft now.
I did my undergrad in literature. Mm-hmm. And I think what people find interesting is that I didn't take that literature degree and then go and pursue an MFA. Mm-hmm. Instead, I actually pursued a second BA. So they had a second BA program at the Academy of Art in San Francisco. And part of the reason I did that was when I looked at the MFA program, the way that it operated and the things that it built itself on were building itself off the assumption that you've had some kind of art training. And I had zero art training. And actually, if you look at my work and if you go on my blog goes all the way back to the beginning of art school, pre-art school even, I think. But my work was terrible. I didn't know what I was doing. And I knew that. I knew that at the time because I started really following a bunch of artists. And so when I looked at the program descriptions, I realized if I went into an MFA, I was going to set myself up to fail. And I didn't want that. I wanted to go in kind of at the ground level and learn what somebody would learn if they were pursuing a BA. So when I looked at the second BA program, it made a lot of sense to me because I really needed foundational work. I needed to learn the basics. And so that's why I went to art school, because I had tried before I enrolled in art school. I went to like these art league classes where everybody's retired except me. And they're just casually painting, and the teacher has no professional experience in art or very little experience in art. And it's just kind of local. And that was fine. But I knew that those classes weren't giving me what I needed. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt that, and I'm also, so I went to art school, but I also don't believe you need to go to art school to become an artist. Mm-hmm. But coming from my background, I was basically at this juncture in my life where I thought, I really want to be an artist. How do I do that? Oh, I go to school. That's how I answer any question. How do I do the thing that I want to do? Go to school. And it's just my upbringing. The answer is always school.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about this because also, again, talking to Mari, Naomi, and Vashti, they also mentioned they didn't go to school for art. And Juyi Morales, she didn't go to school for art. They learned it supplementally. You know, like they... If they did get a degree, they got that degree, and then they pursued art on their own. So yep. What kind of fundamentals are you learning in the kind of collegiate sphere when you're pursuing actual illustration?
So when I went to art school, and I should say this, I didn't say this before, but I dropped out. I dropped out after a year and a half, but I felt that year and a half. I know, right? I'm a very proud art school dropout.
You already had your bachelor's, so you're like, okay.
Exactly. The thing is, I knew I didn't need a second bachelor's. I was just doing it because the course load is what made sense for me and what I wanted to get out of art school. But what I think is interesting is that by having a little bit of art school, but also being a dropout, I feel that I got a little bit of both of those experiences of just kind of like throwing myself into art and just doing it and trying to get better. But prior to that, because I had that year and a half in art school, what I got was a basis of light and shadow and color. And so saying that kind of means it's kind of vague and it doesn't really mean a lot when I think people hear it, but it's really understanding form and shape. And so there are a lot of components to understand when you're trying to understand how to draw and how to illustrate. And I think having just that base understanding of how to level up and the skills required to draw like the 21-year-olds that were around me. I was in my late, like almost, I wasn't almost 30, but I was in my late 20s when I went to art school. And so I was definitely the old lady in class, which is the almost polar opposite experience of going to the art league classes where I was the young one in class. So when I went to school, there were all these students who were way younger than me that could draw circles around whatever I was doing. And so part of the being in that environment was not only the things that I learned, but seeing how other artists operated, being introduced to artists, being introduced to pathways in art and possibilities for a professional career in art. So it wasn't just the actual skills, but it was the exposure to all the different things that art could contribute to my life.
That sounds very technical too.
It was. And it was technical in, I feel, the right ways. There were definitely digital courses there, but I didn't touch computers through the majority of my art school time. And I think that having that traditional skill base where I basically just learned the fundamentals of drawing, being able to draw a figure, a clothed figure, a nude figure, the environments, the backgrounds, how to understand focal point and color theory, it really helped.
And do you feel like that helped you get your specific style, or you were kind of always working towards that?
Oh, I don't know what happened. I honestly don't know how I got my style. It was one of those things that always came up in art school where people would draw something that maybe the teacher didn't appreciate or wasn't asking for. And then the argument was always, but that's my style. And then you would be asked to define it and you couldn't define it. I still don't know how to define my style. Mm-hmm. It's just something that happened. My personality, I started being able to, well, I developed my skills to a point where I was able to allow my personality to come through with the work that I was creating. And so I think that that's a really amazing place to arrive to, but I had to have years of terrible drawings to get there.
I mean, what do you define as terrible?
Well, for me, we're the most harsh on ourselves, right? So I think, I don't know, everything looks wonky. Is that even, mm-hmm. does that even make sense? You know, the anatomy's off, the coloring's off. It might be something you understand is, you know, a girl standing in the rain, but everything else about it isn't really drawing you in. It's not captivating, or one arm is way too long. You know, I don't know. Her features are in the wrong place. Mm-hmm.
So something potentially a layperson would notice, or because there's certain things I feel like we don't notice. And in talking to other visual artists, they'll be like, no, but there's that spot right there. And you're like, I didn't see it until you pointed it out.
It's funny. I was just talking to my husband about this, and I would say, man, an artist should work on, this is a terrible, I probably shouldn't even say this, but an artist should do book reviews of picture books. Like, that should be somebody who is involved in reviewing picture books, because I feel that sometimes when I read these reviews of like picture books that are forthcoming or picture books that just came out, and I'll go and I'll buy them and then I'll regret it immediately because maybe they're responding to the story, or they just don't see it. They don't see what I see, and it makes me cringe that the art is missing the mark, or not even the lighting, because that's such an elevated kind of commentary, but something about it just doesn't feel right, and they're not controlling the eye the way that I feel like a skilled artist could. And at the same time, I'm like, I should never do a review, because I would be so, it would be really hard for me to also be critical in a public forum, because mm-hmm. I've been reviewed. So then I would feel, I don't know, I would feel too nervous to actually put it out in the world.
Yeah. You said you went to school for literature, and then you did, mm-hmm. you focused a lot on your art. I guess, is that really what combines the definition of cartoonist as someone who does both?
I think so.
Okay.
It's interesting though, because now at the place that I'm at, I kind of am, it's like what you said earlier, what do I call myself? Am I an author? Am I an illustrator? Am I a graphic novelist? Am I a cartoonist? But I definitely think that when I'm around a bunch of comics folks, we tend to call ourselves cartoonists. Yeah, I like it, because I think it encapsulates what we do.
That makes sense. I'm trying to get the terminology down, because I know some people are like, oh, I don't feel like I'm a writer, I'm an illustrator.
I think it's also, it speaks to how many different avenues there are within cartooning, right? There's so many styles in comics, there's so many paths, it's just very rich.
I hear you. So getting to Pashmina, which I adore, it's a fast read too, but I realize this is the issue, is that you really need to read graphic novels, I think, more than once. I mean, if you love something, you might want to read it more than once, period. I tend to be a fast reader anyways, because I have to be.
Right.
But with a graphic novel, you need to take in both elements and how they work together, because I don't believe we're taking those in at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I may just be reading it and then glancing at the imagery, and then I need to come back and just look at the imagery. And knowing the story and then look at the imagery. That's how I feel like I should be processing it. Same for picture books, I presume. Like, do a pass, read, get the story down, but then really sit down and look at those images. And I wonder if that's also something, like when you refer to that, I wonder if that's what the reviewers are doing. They're just reading it. And they're not just like, oh yeah, pretty pictures, words.
Right. I think novel that I really enjoy, I read it twice. And I definitely go through the exact same process as you. I read the story first, and then I go back and I really look at the story and the art. And I think that that second read is when I usually know by the end of the book if I love it or not, but I feel like the second pass is where I truly appreciate all of the work that goes into creating a graphic novel.
And for Pashmina, it's been called a feminist book for young readers. So do you feel that that's a term that's accurate in the book that you wanted to make? You know, we have these, it's not wrong to say something is female focused, I think, personally, or that, the gaze is female. It's written by someone who identifies as a female. It's talking about something that females go through. And it also is a story that looks at decisions that women make about their status in life and the societies they inhabit. So was that something you were kind of aiming for? And do you feel like this being called a feminist book is accurate in terms of what you wanted Pashmina to be?
Completely. It's completely accurate, and it makes me really happy because in the process, like you said, you read it really quickly. It took me 4 years to make Pashmina. I talk about this often. It took me 4 years to make. It'll take somebody an hour to read. Yeah. When I was doing a school presentation, this kid came up, and I had mentioned that in the Q&A, and he was super proud of it. And he kind of puffed out his chest. He was like, I read it in 45 minutes.
My life's work was consumed in 45 minutes.
Exactly. But the thing that when I was in the process of making it, and, you know, when you're so close to something, the big worry for me was, one, I didn't want to beat the reader over the head with the message, but I didn't want to not have a message. I didn't want to create this long form work that didn't have something to say. There were multiple times in the editorial process where we were going back and forth between removing some things, adding some things. And there was definitely a point kind of later on in the book where I took away a lot of kind of explanation. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling a little conflicted about it because I wasn't sure if people would then understand that I had something to say, that I wanted to make this statement about women's choice and women's power over their lives. And the fact that it's very evident and people aren't missing that makes me really very happy, because that was definitely one of the themes that I wanted to talk about.
So how, since you are coming off of touring, how is the book being received? What kind of convos do you find yourself having with young readers?
You know, I think that young readers are mostly reacting to how pretty it is, how much they enjoyed reading about a different culture, and how they learned a lot. So they're not having the realization that they're reading a feminist text. Mm-hmm. They're not having those kinds of conversations with me. It's more, oh my gosh, it's so pretty, and I loved reading it, and I, you know, read it a couple times, and I love learning this and that about India. So it's pretty devoid of the conversation of feminism.
Are you talking about culture, though, since they're saying, oh, it's cool to learn about India, and hopefully they're not coming and said, I heard this thing one time.
Right. No, in the grand majority, people are just interested in the fact that they've learned something, and they enjoy that. And they get, I think that the other thing that I've heard from teachers and parents is that their children get engrossed in the fact that it's so, it's pretty and it's a graphic novel. So I think in a lot of ways, the conversation ends up being focused a lot on the art, which is fine, because in the midst of it all, while they're absorbing the art and getting introduced to that kind of form of a graphic novel, they're also learning a few things, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but none of it's resulted in anything problematic so far.
I would hope not. Maybe with the adults.
Right. Yeah.
And hopefully not that either. But I really love the idea of women being able to see their choices. and make further choices from that. Even if I take away the kind of thinking of feminism, what that means for the body, the female body and female consciousness of what's holding us back. And Shakti, she says, you won't be bound by fear. And is that also something you kind of thought about a lot in terms of the development of this larger book of, because I'm always interested in process of, well, how does it come? Maybe you read something one day and then boom, I want to write a book about this and it becomes something else. So I don't know if that was kind of something you were always working towards or that's something that came out the more you worked on it.
I found that question really interesting because it's much deeper than the question that I'm normally asked, which is where do you get your inspiration and where did this book come from? And so I think in order to really accurately answer that question, I have to say that it came from both things. It came from this idea of wanting to tell a story about a mom and a daughter with a magical shawl. And that has been an idea that I've had for some great time now. Actually, the basis of Peshmina, which is really small in the book, when Priyanka opens a suitcase and she finds the Peshmina, that was based off a memory that I've had of my parents going to India, coming back with a suitcase full of objects from India that seemed familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. It was all these things that I knew and I had seen either in film or at Indian grocery stores or Indian sari shops, but there it was collected in this suitcase, and there were all these smells and all these snacks and feet and objects that I didn't really recognize, but it all felt like part of this place that I knew. And I remember that experience, and it left an imprint on my memory. Mm-hmm. And I thought for a long time about how I was opening a suitcase to another world. But it was a world that I also felt comfortable in. So it wasn't something that was a complete fantasy world, right? It was kind of partly known and partly fantasy. And so all those things were the basis of Peshmina. But then when I started working on Peshmina and I started thinking about, where does this shawl come from? Why is this shawl in Priyanka's life? And part of that came from me asking that question. And then when we got deeper and deeper into the process of working on the book, part of that also came out of results of conversations with my editor, Mark Siegel, and he's the gentlest, most wonderful editor. And one of the things that I love about Mark is he would never tell me what to do, and he would never suggest anything that I should do, but he would just ask me questions. And often when I would get off the phone with him, I would take whatever work I submitted to him in the recent past and throw it all away and start again, because he asked me questions that either I couldn't answer or that made me question what I had worked on enough so to think that the next pass would be a better, stronger book.
We're looking at identity here. To me, it didn't seem as though this is about a young Indian American girl dealing with you know, her Indianness, you know, for lack of a better word. It was dealing with not knowing things, not really knowing her mother, not knowing her father, these relationships, mm-hmm. not being confident in herself as an artist, and just trying to reconcile itself with family history and all that stuff.
Yep.
That's what stuck out to me about it. You know what, in this time that we're talking about diverse books, it's not about an Indian American girl wanting to be American, whatever the hell that means, which usually translates to white.
Right. It's not an assimilation story, nor is it a story about her fighting against assimilation. It's truly a story about her being in this place where for her whole life, she hasn't had all these questions answered. And that's been acceptable and fine, but all of a sudden she's a teenager. And these mm-hmm. these acceptable secrets are now unacceptable because she really is at this place where she's trying to develop and understand her own identity and her sense of self. And she can't do that without knowing where she came from.
Exactly. The adults don't have it all figured out either. No. And that's refreshing to see too. You know, sometimes adults aren't really in the kids' books, or they're kind of in there as a foil. Like mm-hmm. they usually play a couple roles, adults. It's either They're the authority, or they're the foil, or maybe they're the best friend, or something like that. But in here, we're actually seeing, like, when with Pri's aunt trying to make decisions, and also her uncle, her adopted uncle, and all these things that everyone's dealing with in terms of being new parents and trying to figure out their relationship. I really enjoyed that, those aspects of it that made it feel familiar too.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that it's interesting. It's not something that I thought about when I was creating Peshmina, that a lot of books that are written for younger audiences skip over the adults and remove them from the narrative, because then it becomes really child-focused. And that's also exciting and fun for children to read. But that was never my reality. My youth, I think all kids are surrounded by adults, even though they have their own pursuits and own dramas that play out in their lives that don't necessarily involve adults. But my dramas and the things that I was dealing with as a kid were always related to my family, or understanding my family and understanding who I was. And that resulted in me asking a lot of questions from the adults that were around. So it's interesting to me now. I'm reading a lot of YA and middle grade books, and I notice that. I notice how focused it is on friends and other kids. And I think that's interesting, because that's not 100% true for everybody.
But we were talking a little bit about this before I hit the record button, about graphic novels and getting more visibility. Do you feel as though they're getting a bit more visibility? Or maybe because you're immersed in that world, you may have a different perspective?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to have that perspective, because for me, you know, I went to Miami Book Fair. I just got back on Sunday, and, you know, I was like, there's so many cartoonists here, you know. They have like a whole graphic novel section, and they have graphic novel specific programming. And so I feel that it's truly integrated into all of publishing. But then in also in having conversations with cartoonists and writers, I also realize it's definitely a small segment of publishing in general, but graphic novels have been selling. It's selling better and better every year. And I'm totally going to fumble and forget what the stats are. I know a bunch of other people know the stats better than I do, but year over year, graphic novels are selling more and more. And so I think that what's also happening that is really interesting in the industry is that I'm noticing there are more acquisitions of graphic novels. There is more interest in people who are looking to purchase graphic novels. So I've seen some agents and some publishing houses make calls and say, we're specifically looking for graphic novels within this genre. So I think all of that is really, really interesting, because it's meeting the demand of the market. And the demand of the market is saying, we need more graphic novels, and we need more graphic novels that aren't just fitting into these four boxes, you know, of this kind, and that kind. We actually need the whole depth and breadth of literature that we see in prose novels to be reflected in graphic novels as well.
Do you have any advice for someone who is trying to get their foot in the door into graphic novels, or some kind of visibility as someone who's doing that work? Because I don't know if it's similar.
I mean, it's so interesting, because that's such a specific question, and I always want to have some advice that somebody could really utilize. You know, I don't want to just give your regular write every day or draw all the time. Although those are the reason that people say those is because they're true. Part of the reason that I developed my skills to the point that I could even feel like I could make Peshmina was because I drew every day for 3 years and, you know, made myself accountable to myself to produce a finished illustration every day for, you know, 3 full years. So I definitely think that honing your craft, developing your craft is worthwhile, and starting small. So I did a bunch of small, slice of life comics before I really started to realize that comics is a very complicated medium. You have to be an actor, you have to be a director, you have to be a writer, and you have to be an artist. And so there's a lot of components into creating a good comic, as there is creating any good art. And so I think, you know, starting small is always a good rule of thumb so that you don't get overwhelmed. And also realizing that it's a process, that the journey is long, and that every time there is an impediment or a speed bump that gets in the way, if you just keep pushing through, you'll get to another place. Mm-hmm. And it might not be the place, like the, you know, place that you dream of, but try not to let those speed bumps stop you.
Were you waiting? Were you building your portfolio before you went to an agent?
So I went to my agent with a completely different project. It was called Hinglish. And it was a memoir. And at the time, this was like, I think 6 years ago. I can't even remember now. I'm really bad with time. Huh?
Was it a graphic memoir or straight?
Yes, it was a graphic memoir. I had spent almost a year thumbnailing it out. And so I sent it to her and a few other agents. So I was looking for agents at the time. And she and another agent responded and they were interested. And my agent, Judy Hansen, she had this roster of people that she represented that I felt really comfortable with. And the other agent that I can't even remember her name now, she didn't have any graphic novelists. And I felt like, oh, I should go with a person who has knowledge of comics because it's very specific. And so she said that the manuscript or the thumbnails needed work. But prior to advising them, I needed to think about getting legal permission. So this is something I don't talk about too much, mostly because I don't want to, but I had a really abusive childhood. I had a very complicated, hard childhood. My life now is kind of the polar opposite of what it used to be. And I'm just that's why a lot of times I say things and talk about how grateful I am, because I know what life used to be like. And what it is now is kind of far cry from what it used to be. And so when she reviewed that memoir, she said, well, in order for us to publish this, you need to get legal sign-offs from the people that are in this, because it is a lot of stuff that's really intense. And there's, you know, open discussion about abuse and everything. And so as soon as she said that, I was like, and I'm done. And we're not going to publish this. And that's just never going to see the light of day. I'm not doing that, because that would require me to go back to people that I haven't talked to in a very, very long time. And I'm just not going to open up that wound. And in retrospect, now that I'm where I'm at and in talking to other people who've written memoirs, I'm really happy that I didn't do that, because part of where I'm at now in my life is I'm happy. I feel surrounded by love and support and artists and writers and just a really great community. And I feel that if I had written a memoir that was focused on a really dark time in my life, it would potentially force me to relive all that dark time all of the time.
And pigeonhole, because we do pigeonhole artists.
Right. And so I'm just happy. But how I see that memoir and that time that I spent, it got me this wonderful agent. She's fierce. She's amazing. She's just a wonderful person to have in your team and your corner. And so if it's never going to see the light of day. I'm happy about that, but it did its job. You know, its job was to get me to Judy.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Fierce agents are good. They get you money.
Mm-hmm. It's very true.
You scrapped the memoir. What did that when you said, oh, I happen to be working on this thing called Pashmina, or I have this idea for this thing?
No, I actually tabled kind of comics for a while.
Oh, yeah?
Huh?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a lot. It was a lot of kind of like ramping myself up to maybe selling this book and working on that other book. And so I felt kind of deflated by it. And so I think it was 6-8 months before I started thinking about Pashmina. And then a think the whole course of like revising the manuscript for Pashmina and then it getting acquired was probably in and around 4 or 5 months, but I can't remember. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it was, if you look from timeline, and again, I fully admit that I have no concept of time, and my concept of time is really messed up, but I would say that it was probably about a year in between. So it wasn't like I tabled Hinglish and then I went straight into Pashmina. I had no idea what I was going to do next.
So it's okay not to know.
Like... Yes, exactly. That's a good takeaway.
So let's talk about art as resistance. And you have some downloads on your website, Everyday Love. I don't know how you felt being an artist at this time. I know it was really rough for people whose work came out last November and in January.
Right.
That sucked.
I can imagine.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I'm knocking on wood. It means I'm knocking on my head because I'm not near wood readily. God, if I publish a book in 2020, please make it be under good circumstances.
Right. I know.
I'm interested in seeing how do you see art, or I'm interested in knowing how do you see art as a form of resistance? You know, your style is, I think, very embracing. It's called Everyday Love. It seems like it's called Everyday Love for a reason. And I feel like that kind of very much encapsulates this kind of warm, inviting kind of style you have. And I don't know if that clarifies it to people who aren't familiar with your style. I'll just say go to Nidhi's site and you'll figure it out.
Yeah, so it's everydaylovart.com. But here's how I feel about art and art as a political tool. When I was in college, I really started to understand more and more about who I was and what I wanted to do in my life. And a lot of that led me to being very involved in on-campus activist groups. And so I was involved in Queers of Color. I was involved in the AAPI group. I was involved in a lot of different organizations that were doing protests on campus. I did a couple trips to DC and we met with representatives. And so I was very involved in kind of understanding how our voices could have an impact, but it also exhausted me. It felt to me like I was being angered, or I was being put in a position to be political. I needed to be angry. And I started to really think about how that felt like a trap, and that didn't necessarily need to be how it was, but I didn't know at the time any other way, because all the people that I knew who were fiercely political, who were making statements, who were going to protest, they were upset and they were angry. And there is a lot of value to that. And I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's necessary. But for me, having had the background that I had and understanding a lot about where I was and who I was, I didn't really want to spend my time feeling that feeling. And so when I left school and I thought about art and I thought about politics, I really wanted to figure out a way that I could be political without being overtly angry. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that my art makes this statement that's pretty clear. Like you said, it is embracing and welcoming, but I feature a lot of things in my art that you don't typically see. And that in and of itself is a statement. But beyond that, when we got to this place where our country kind of got thrown into this really ugly mess, I couldn't not make something that was way more direct. And that's why I made those resistance posters and I made them free to download, because I wanted people to have tools where they could look at something that was, you know, again, my resistance posters are also really kind of cute. Even though they talk about, you know, resisting, or they say you should resist, and they're made in a way that they can be coloring pages, and they have been used, and I've gotten a lot of messages from teachers and librarians as tools to start the conversation. And so that's a definitely more direct. But prior to that, it was just me drawing beautiful illustrations with women of color as the feature, you know, or mixed race couples or queer couples, and just having us represented in beautiful art was also such a statement, because there are so few representations of that. And so for me, I think I've found a way, and maybe people who follow my work don't know that, and that's fine too, because in a way it makes me so privately and publicly happy that these kids from all different backgrounds, white, black, Indian, Asian, come up and they see two brown mermaids mm-hmm. dancing in the water, and they're like, I want that. And then they put that up in their wall. Mm-hmm. And that to me means that these kids are growing up with representations of people that look like them or don't look like them. And it's part of their life. And that to me changes the dynamic. It changes the idea of beauty, the idea of, yeah, representation. And it allows us to see that we're all in this, and we all deserve beautiful art. We all deserve to be represented. Anyways, sorry, that was such a tangent.
No, that's good. I really appreciate what you said about someone saying to be political is to be angry. Mm-hmm. And that resonates so much, because that's especially, I mean, you know, you're on Twitter.
Yep.
We're in similar groups online.
Yes.
Anger is such a prevalent emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel like anger is an emotion. I think it can be categorized as a reaction, but I do feel anger is an emotion. And frustration. And maybe those two tie in together. It is good to hear someone say that doesn't need to be the default to be active.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to be present in the conversation, that you can take away some positivity, or just, you know, actionable conscience that doesn't need to be ranting online, and just kind of put it into the art itself.
Exactly. And I think that, I mean, it's not that I don't do the protests, and I don't, like, I spent part of my day off today calling representatives about net neutrality. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to participate in those ways too. But the bulk of my life, I want to embrace who I feel I am. Mm-hmm. And I feel that I've arrived in a place in my life and with my family and the things that I surround myself with is a place of happiness. And so if I can put happy stuff into the world, I do feel that happy art takes us to a different place. It changes the conversation. It changes the dynamic. And art has that place in our community, in our conversations, mm-hmm. and in our world that allows us to take a break and to really engage in a way that makes us hopefully see each other instead of just always kind of combating each other. Mm. I don't know.
No, that totally makes sense, because even I get tired.
Right. Yeah.
The anger, because I think after last year's presidential election in the United States.
Yep.
I mean, it was just kind of pent up. And then it's the anticipation, and then the inauguration happened. And then you're like, holy crap, this is real now. And now we are where we are, where we're literally calling our reps weekly, if not biweekly at this point, about something. Even I lose track after a while. And you get really tired of talking to people about the same thing. White supremacy is wrong. You know, heteronormative values need to not overwhelm us. Cisgender people can be a problem. Ableism is a thing.
Right. And
Islamophobia
just
is real.
and I think that the thing is, for me, when I think about those things and I think about those conversations, what's happening is not only are those conversations are necessary because of the place that our country is at right now, mm-hmm. but the problem with those conversations, I find, is that because we're having that conversation right now, this is the thing that makes me the most angry. I'm going to get like really riled up right now. But because we're having those conversations, because we're having to fight those fights, because we're taking our time to call those representatives and fight the things that we felt maybe were put to bed, or at least not like a kind of a basic things like white supremacy, that all of that space that it's taking in our lives, in our conversations, in our social media, in it permeates everything. Mm-hmm. And not only does it cause kind of like this base level of sadness and depression, mm-hmm. but it's preventing us from actually moving forward, from having mm-hmm. conversations that take us to the next step, that take us to the next story, the next piece of art, the next dialogue that's going to advance us. And instead, we're going backwards and having conversations that have already been happening. And mm-hmm. I'm like flaring my nostrils right now. That's what really makes me upset, is that we're now having conversations that are keeping us at a stasis instead of moving us forward. And yeah. that really drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. No, it's a legitimate argument. And that's when I said this year, I'm not doing this for free anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I did stop volunteering. And I said, I will only do things that are paid if you want me to educate you. I had to. And, you know, I'm not making a mint off of it, but it makes me feel better.
Yeah,
because
that's
I'm
good.
Being compensated for my time instead of me constantly doing this work for free. And that way, if I do want to do something for free, it's kind of happy making. Like, oh, I'll work with some kids and do a workshop with some children, which I should still be paid for. But, you know,
yeah,
like
exactly.
talking to kids is much more joyful for me
mm-hmm.
than having to tell you about the issues in
yep.
bad Black representation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're going to do that and you're going to put me through that, I need to get paid. And I think that helps because I agree with you still. We're in the hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, we're going round and round and round. But at least your time is being compensated. At least you're getting paid. So your energy is getting something. You don't get that time back, unfortunately, and you don't necessarily get that energy back, but you have money in your bank account.
That's true. It's a very good point. I mean, there's got to be something that softens the blow, because the blow is hard and the blow sucks.
It is. And if I want to buy some shoes, guess what?
Yep. Exactly.
I'll take that money, that racism talk money, and buy some shoes. Right. This is going to be an eat out fancy week.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna eat my
exactly. I mean, gotta even out, man. I mean, and that's real talk, you know?
Yeah.
There's gotta be something.
Exactly. You need,
because otherwise we're floating in this just sea of crap.
Literal. Literal. And I don't know how to swim. I'm sinking in it. It's waist deep now. That's
yeah.
I appreciate that. I did give an authenticity read to a woman, and we were on the phone for an hour, and she said, I should be paying you for this. And I said, I'm glad I didn't have to say that.
Nice.
I was like, this is where your understanding is coming from, is understanding my time is valuable.
Yeah.
And I think that's a small, small bit of progress. So I hope what people take from this episode is, pay us.
Yes. Artists need money to make more art.
We like to eat.
And to eat, right. And to eat, to pay rent. Yeah. You know,
Nitty has a kid.
Right.
She has a child.
Yeah.
I want to help her out. Thank you so much for being on. And I'm glad this came to fruition. We planned this again a year ago. So I'm glad this planned out.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love your podcast. I can't wait to catch up when I start drawing again.
Thank you for being a longtime listener.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a great podcast.
Pashmina is such a great book, so I'm very glad it's out in the world. And I hope, if you haven't bought it, well, guess what? This episode posts before Christmas, so gift-giving time. And how may people reach out to you, get your work, become more familiar with your work?
So my website is everydayloveart.com. And then you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. It is Nidhi Art, which is Nidhiart. And then I have a Facebook fan page as well. But if you just Google it, you'll find it because it's a much longer name that anybody would ever want to know.
And Pashmina is out now from First Second, which is a division of Macmillan. And you have another book coming out with First Second.
Yeah, so it's scheduled for 2020, and it's called Jukebox. And it's about two Muslim American cousins who find a jukebox that takes them back in time.
Ooh, we're getting more mysticism.
Yep.
Yay. Do you think you'll do similarly with the color variation?
Yeah, actually, I'm right now just kind of cerebrally figuring out how I want to play with color this time because I don't want it to be the same. I want it to be a different level or a different treatment. And so I haven't figured it out yet, but definitely color will play an important role, as I feel it should in a visual medium.
It should. And I really love the detail in Pashmina with the Pashmina. About the Pashmina.
Well, thank you.
I could say scarf, but that's not accurate. For everyone who's listening, I wish you a wonderful and peaceful and stress-free 2017. And the podcast will be back in 2018, the second week of January. And I will have a new guest. I have a backlog of episodes. I'll have episodes, recordings of the i2arts Creative Conversations from the fall, and a whole slew of more wonderful, marginalized, underrepresented people who are gracing the podcast, and I'm very thankful for their presence, and I'm thankful for you, Nidhi, and everyone who's been on the podcast going on 3+ years.
I'm thankful to you, Jen. Thank you so much for creating this space and interviewing some amazing people. I can't wait. I really, really can't wait to catch up.
So happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.